How's the old ILC going?
Really, really well, man. It's going really great. We just had a remote meeting with a bunch of different chapter people. Arizona's going awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. That's wonderful. Where in Arizona?
Based around Phoenix, but there's some people like spread, because Arizona is so big, spread out around. New York is going awesome. We've got people going to Canada to set stuff up. Canadians coming here to meet. Looks like in August, we're going to try to start a Chicago chapter. We got a lot of interest there. And Melbourne, Australia just met the other day, which is exciting.
Damn, that's spreading pretty quick. Congrats. That's really great.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. The only thing is, we don't, you know, it's like we don't really have the structure in place to be spread so thin. So we're trying to figure out like what we're capable of right now in terms of spreading, you know?
Yeah, like what do you, that's like you have all these people. It's like, all right, well, now what?
Yeah, then you gotta like figure out shit to do. We've found public events to be pretty successful so far, which keeps everybody with something going on, you know?
Very cool. Yeah.
We should talk about it all today on the show.
I can keep things vague, absolutely. Like, I'm happy to speak in generalities and stuff.
It's like a communist Manhattan project.
Yeah, that's right. Communism is the people's bomb.
Yeah, we'll discover the new element, comradium, which only blows up bourgeois power structures. Leaves proletarian power intact, yeah.
Look, they say you can't blow up a social relation, but our guys are on it.
Yeah.
We got our best scientists on it right now.
We got our communist R&D lab.
Yeah.
It's really the only thing you can blow up.
Yeah.
That and the Trade Center. That was an incredible blow against the value form, I tell you.
They said it couldn't be done, and then they did it.
In 2001, I was 6 years old, and so just the gravity of the situation was just lost on me. I was like, the next day on 9/12, my friends and I were pretending to be like buildings and airplanes, and like, flying into each other, like.
And your parents are like, too soon, guys. Come on.
Yeah.
It's gonna be funny in like a few years.
Yeah, I think my friends waited like 3 weeks before we were cracking jokes about it. Maybe 2 weeks.
I will admit that I was cracking jokes about it on the morning of.
All right. We can get this call of white men for Kamala Harris together.
Yes. Slay.
Are we all brats now? Is that it?
Yeah, whatever the fuck that means. What does it mean to say she's brat? What does that mean?
I don't know. I'm still trying to decipher this.
I think it means she's a sassy woman. All right. So, yeah, I suggested for this episode we talk about all of the great current events, you know, Biden sundowning, coconut pills, couch fucking cat ladies and all that stuff. But our guest today, Nick Chavez and Phil Neal, who we had on earlier this year to talk about Forest and Factory, their great essay about what communism will look like and all of its fantastic details, said, no, that's boring. That's peasant shit. We want to talk about supply chains, industrial policy, wars and revolutions in Africa, Chinese imperialism, and productive subjectivity, which is a term that neither Sean and I were familiar with. So you really threw us for a loop with that one. I thought maybe I was just stupid, but I was Googling around, and it's not a commonly used idea. So we got a lot to get to.
Yeah, you're here to school us. And as always on this show, and kind of as like a prophylactic, we make sure whoever it is we have on the show is not qualified to talk about Biden sundowning or Kamala Harris or couch fucking or whatever. We've got our best two guys on it. So welcome to the show, dudes.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to be back.
Where should we start? Andy, you want to start on this productive subjectivity question? We think this maybe comes from the Grundrisse?
That was my best guess.
You want to go for it, Phil? I think you have a better grasp of the genealogy of the term than I do.
Well, the genealogy is a little bit messy. I would say the main people who use it now are the people out of Argentina. The name is in Spanish, and I always forget it or mix it up because I don't speak any Spanish. But
the CICP.
The CICP. And it's something just like Center for Political Economy, something. But it's this kind of cluster of thinkers around that school and sort of came out of open Marxism circles as well. they're the ones who use it kind of most actively. Now, part of what they're doing is digging back into the use of some of these concepts of the collective worker and the total social capital and all of that from which is developed in the Grundrisse, but also changes in very important ways between the Grundrisse and capital. And so there's a bunch of debate about, like, when we talk about like the collective worker and the general intellect, Marx actually makes all these really important edits between the Grundrisse and capital. And if you look at some of what like the post-autonomists are reading in the Grundrisse, it's actually specifically things that Marx like took out when he wrote Capital, which was, you know, the thing that he was like, yeah, we'll go with this, publish this. This is for the public facing kind of argument, right? So a lot of these people kind of are putting back in the elements from Capital, which emphasizes a lot more of the divisions in the collective worker that are imposed by the International Division of Labor. And that's a big point of focus for this school of people based in Argentina, which is looking at what's called like the new International Division of Labor. And that's where we get to like those kind of importance of supply chains, value chains, et cetera, et cetera. As for the concept, the definition of productive subjectivity, I think Nick can pick it up on that side.
Pick it up what exactly?
Like, how would you define productive subjectivity?
It's kind of a complicated thing because it's a term that these CIC people use in kind of a singular fashion with this like implication of basically what boils down to like labor autonomy and like kind of the individual level of control like a particular worker has over their work. But it's not really that simple, of course. There's a lot more to it. It's this kind of, when we say subjectivity, we kind of mean like, What does a person even conceive of as being possible with relating to production? And that sounds kind of convoluted, but that really means like, how do people, like, we have production as this global system that operates beyond the control of any, not just any one person, but like not even the capitalist class. Like, it's not like individual capitalists all like, you know, if you add up all their control, you get like the total control over capital. No, it's like there's all these like emergent dynamics that nobody has any control over. And so there's this system that nobody fully truly can like comprehend in its totality, but, you know, like little pieces of it are understood by all sorts of different people. And the productive subjectivity is the way that this kind of this totality like forms an appearance at the level of like an individual person's ideological schemas of how the world works, like their internal mental map and model of how things work in society. And so the capitalism has this division of labor that's very inherent to it. It's both this division of labor, like in an individual, you know, manufacturing line where you get like, you know, you polarize like expertise and control and decision-making power in like engineers and managers and senior technicians. And then you have, you know, the whole point of doing that is to then strip decision-making power away from people lower on this kind of expertise hierarchy. And that's kind of like in isolation, but then the way this manifests across all of society is like way more complicated. You get, you know, as a productive technology gets more sophisticated through history, you get like this growth of all these other industries that are, where, you know, if you look at like steampunk ass Victorian England or whatever, the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, you know, there weren't like all these massive like business service firms and everything, but now those exist. And right. Those are all, it's not like those are like a parasite on production, you know, the like the real economy or anything like that. Like, no, it's all production, the production of commodities, which is the heart of capitalist, the heart of capitalism really is commodity production. And you, in order to make commodities and importantly sell them, like get them to the point of sale, like long after they're made, you now have this entire complex, like business ecosystem of, in order to make that happen. But, you know, so what happens is that like at the individual level of like workers going to their job every day and managers like keeping the numbers up in their, you know, their department, they have all these, there's these like appearances of like, you know, we understand like the word productivity is a really good example. If you look at like any company, you know, they have their expenses, they have their revenue, and, you know, you can look at maybe in a given period of time, you know, expenses versus revenue, and you can calculate profit and like, this company is productive because they turn a profit, and you can say they're like, 20% productive, they're 5% productive, whatever. But that's not really like the same way that productive, like you would think of productivity in terms of like the total global economic ecosystem of like where production only happens in one area, but then all these other things are not tied to it. So money and I guess if we don't have to get deep in the weeds on what value is, that's a podcast series.
It's another series, exactly.
I'm rambling, but what I'm getting, let me bring it back to the main point here. The main point here is that these forms of appearance that everything takes, the particular way that the appearances of production take in the minds of workers is productive subjectivity. And we can, Phil and I can both talk about the way that that gets, that differs in different parts of the proletariat. Cause you have not only like, you know, like I said, on the production line where some people have less and some people have more, but there's also like, what about people who don't touch any wrenches or work in warehouses or anything like that? Like they also have what some people call like a very degraded productive subjectivity, despite the fact that their work is also integral to like the circulation and the realization of commodities and everything. So
if I can get this straight, then so individuals have productive subjectivity in that they have a mental map or like an individual understanding of all the various different nodes and units of capital. They have a vague sense of how goods are made and moved, and eventually the final product arrives to them. But that subjectivity isn't like, it's part of the, it comes out of their experience with the production process, but also like common sense notions and common sense falsifications of how production works in capitalist society. Is that it or no?
Let me try to jump in. Researching this, I did find, I guess I was on the right track because I found this essay by Guido Starosta from CICP. Yeah. And my understanding of it was he was looking at this concept, the way it works in Capital, especially the chapter on the working day, and then in Grundrisse leading up to the fragment on machines. And my impression from the article is that, you know, there's one aspect of workers' struggle that's like, you know, trying to limit the working day, trying to improve the conditions of the worker collectively. But then that generalizes into this universal worker and this universal working class consciousness, which understands or tries to reappropriate the scientific general intellect, the overarching logic of the entire thing, and put it under workers' control. So it approaches this general productive science and consciousness of that science and the ability of workers in mass as individuals and as a collective to determine the outcomes of production.
Yeah, so Starosta's a couple of things. I want to go back to a couple of things that Nick said, and then I want to talk about Starosta as well. So part of this, I think, is that personally, I think that we have to be a little bit careful and a little bit more precise in how we talk about productive subjectivity. Part of it also, I think, is that Nick and I may have minor disagreements about exactly how we understand it at the level of the individual. On my end, and also for the way that Starosta tends to approach it, is that subjectivity. And so for me, this comes from two different places. When we talk about like political subjectivity, for example, we're usually talking about collective subjectivity, not individual subjectivity, right? Someone can have an individual form of knowledge, but not subjectivity in this broader philosophical sense, which is being part of this collective body. And then the other part that really pulls this idea out for me is also having taught a lot of statistics, where there's this whole idea of like, you can never generalize from that distribution to an individual in that kind of clean way. Like literally the individual is kind of dimensionless in that distribution. So there's actually interesting mathematical problems that come up when you try to do that. But the point is just that for me, I think it actually is very important to say that productive subjectivity is not something that individuals possess. Individuals possess productive knowledge that is an emanation in part of the collective productive subjectivity that they express. And express is also an important point there because as we kind of got at just a second ago, this isn't really knowledge in your head either, right? So I say kind of knowledge, we could say knowledge and experience or something like that, knowledge and practice. It's also something that you're doing kind of every day in league with all kinds of machine systems, right, which are kind of an integral part of the knowledge itself, all kinds of like non-human systems, ecological or in terms of like agricultural, domesticated animals, et cetera, right? So when we're talking about these forms of productive subjectivity, we're talking about them at this kind of collective level primarily, and then they instantiate in the form of individual forms of productive knowledge, right? Even at that collective level, and here's the thing that Starosta actually talks about. I think that the summary of Starosta is a little bit, it reads a portion of it, but I don't know what you read, but like when you get deeper into his work, it gets all these kind of additional onion layers of complexity, dialectical inversions and whatnot, where initially it sounds a lot like what you said, like, okay, we're kind of trying to recover some aspect of the collective work of the general intellect. And in general, that's true, but Starosta is also very, very explicit about the collective worker, the general intellect, the social brain, all these different words that Marx uses, it only exists through subdivision within capital. It only exists in war with itself. It only exists divided by the division of, just slaughtered by the division of labor, basically across the surface of the earth, in terms of practical activity, in terms of the interest that people have in their subsistence struggles in the workplace, right? They're often in contradiction to one another because, there's plenty of examples where a normal subsistence kind of struggle that emerges out of a particular workplace in a wealthy country, right, will have like an imperial character relative to other countries. So we can see that with, all kinds of nationalists like ban Chinese electric cars types of union demands, right? So he's very, very explicit. These things are internally divided, and that actually, so his book, I forget what it's called. It's got one of those very, very generic names.
It's so hard to remember because it's just like this like long string of like Marxist words, like Marxist words. Yeah.
Is it Marx's like Capital, Method, and Revolutionary Subjectivity?
That's the one.
That's it, yeah. So yeah. It's a very good book. It's very interesting. It's very weird. I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but it's like definitely a book that I think everyone should read, but it's like very, very hard. It is... basically asking this second question, which follows from the question of productive subjectivity, which is, given that productive subjectivity is only exists at this collective level as divided against itself, how does anything like revolutionary subjectivity emerge from that? So how is there a revolutionary project that can fuse that into a collective project to do more of that thing of like take on these kind of the scientific capacities of the human species and use it for, the well-being of all, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm trying to connect this to my everyday life, and I'm trying to connect it to what I do for a living. And I'm trying to think about it, as you said, and trying to understand like knowledge of production and the power that brings when organized. And also perhaps like the overcoming of production in that sense. There's all these different work processes that we do. There's all these different ways in which like the long train of hundreds of years of not just technological development, but like the domination of capital leads any of the people, for example, in my local to a job site where it's like mastery over this machine, mastery over this geography, mastery over the particular capitalists, such as is possible, leads to a certain sense of, sense of power, collective power, but that only ever reaches the moment of trade union consciousness. I'm like, how could I understand this idea of productive subjectivity in my everyday life, let's say in like heavy construction? Can you give me an example of how I might, when I'm using like $1 million vibratory hammer to put in like an 80-foot sheet, and I've got like 100 and so people on the job, but there's only 5 of us who have won the right, through collective bargaining and through our collective power to utilize this machine and to use our knowledge in order to like have the power to make a decent living out of that.
So it's the question of how do I relate this back to my own individual kind of mental schema of the world. So I mean, Phil is right. Like I was talking about it like in a way that we can kind of try to think about it in terms of like individuals, like individual productive knowledge is it greatly like determines collective productive subjectivity, but feels right. It is above all a collective thing. And so how you understand it as an individual, I guess I'll kind of reconstitute that question as like, what can we say about the productive subjectivity of construction workers generally, or the workers who have some kind of tangible, like learned skill that they utilize on a bunch of machinery? Maybe it's a better way to think of this question. And the answer to that would sound something more like the answer is basically like, how does the commodity fetish like manifest for different groups of workers? And that's kind of what it boils down to. Cause I mean, the collective experience of capitalist production for workers is through this modality of wage labor. We show up, we get paid a wage we do the work first, then we get paid a wage. Mm. And then we leave and do it all again the next day. And so the way that works is like, you know, there's very much this like tie between like our, you know, our spent labor power and money and everything. But then when it comes to like machines, you know, you show up to the job site, the machines are there already, or I mean, mm-hmm. someone brings them at least. You didn't go like mine all the like ore and then refine it into metals and turn them eventually into these machines. And I'm not speaking about you specifically, Sean.
I definitely didn't mine that shit. Right about that.
I mean, I don't either. So don't feel bad. I don't artisanally construct every machine that I use at my job.
Do I want to be quite honest.
Yeah, fuck that. That's actually a good point. Like, you know, we ain't no one got time for that. No. But when workers use machines, they take this form of appearance of like an already existing thing for them to use. It is a commodity. Like someone bought this commodity. The commodity was made with someone else's labor power. And so you as skilled workers, you may understand this part, like collectively, you know, construction workers or like blue collar skilled trades people, whatever, may understand machinery or things like machines as something that you can like develop. You have like a sense of autonomy over this thing that is a commodity. But the thing is, of course, it's still a commodity. You don't really have mastery over it. You just get like a little bit more say in like one piece of this commodity's journey through its like lifetime of being like labor power circulating back and forth forever.
Right.
So that's maybe I don't know if that like that probably opens more questions than it really answers, but that's maybe a good way to think about how to look at productive subjectivity of like a group of workers.
Well, maybe we can keep this in mind as we move a bit into some current events and then work our way towards a bonus where we will get back to some fun utopian theories about what communism might be like.
Cause that last episode you guys were on for, that shit hit, man. That was a great one. People wanted more. So we're giving it to them in the bonus half.
But now you're going to eat your vegetables. And so there's two subjects that you guys suggested we talk about. I think they're both very good. The first is industrial relocation, reshoring and friendshoring, which are two essential parts of both Biden and Trump's platforms. I assume Kamala will integrate this as well. Phil suggested talking about a little bit about what's going on in East Africa, in Kenya, in Sudan, and its relationship to China and this, you know, reshifting of global power alliances. So those are two related subjects. Where do you think we should start with those?
Yeah, where do you guys want to jump in?
I think I can build a little bridge between what we were just talking about and some of the political stuff going on in Africa and these questions of big global restructuring, and then end it with where this U.S. reshoring thing touches in relation to that.
Great. But just like China, you'll build a Belt and Road for us to travel from the Grundrisse to the current day.
And I was going to ask before you start if you guys heard the episode I did a couple of weeks ago with Jason Smith of the Brooklyn Rail.
I heard
Nigeria
it,
and China. Yeah. So I feel like this is actually a good continuation to a bridge for that speculative episode we did with Jason. Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, I did not hear the episode, but the for context for viewers, I did a bunch of research, formal research for my dissertation on Chinese industrial relocation within China. So the changing kind of nature of Chinese industrial districts in the Pearl River Delta, their relocation of lower end industries to the Chinese interior, and then also relocation of Chinese industry to East Africa, specifically Tanzania, but kind of looking more broadly at what's called like global China studies today. And that involved on the ground field work in the Pearl River Delta in China, and also doing basically a field survey of all the industrial districts in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and interviewing people on the ground in Chinese and Swahili and English sometimes, and basically looking for Chinese factories there. And the biggest thing that you find when you do that, when you go out and actually like look for this stuff, because we all know the narrative. The narrative is that there's this ascendant Chinese imperialism and it's doing this and that and that. And then either, depending on your political predilection, it's either a good thing or a bad thing, right? So it's a bad thing if you're kind of right-wing U.S. person or particular kind of factions of local politicians in countries in Africa, or it's a good thing if you kind of think, well, it's a challenge to U.S. imperialism and it's developmental because they're building roads or whatever. They're building roads, they're building ports, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with both of the accounts is that they have a vested interest in pretending that it exists in this particularly strong form. Mm. Now, the provocative way that I present this is basically just that the Belt and Road doesn't exist. All of this stuff that we hear about China doing overseas, it's much, much more complicated. The Chinese role in it is much more mild. It's not that China isn't important. It's just that the economic relationships are completely different than they are portrayed. They're often portrayed as China. Like you'll say, oh, this is a Chinese project, you know, and that it's the implication that it's Chinese investment, that it's Chinese firms, at least as the main contractors, something like that. But a lot of times people are referring to projects that aren't Chinese in any real respect. Maybe there's a Chinese subcontractor working on it, but the money is coming from somewhere else. So the point is basically that when we look at the changing global division of labor, this social distribution of productive knowledge, basically the social distribution of productive subjectivity, it is very important to trace how industrialization is kind of proceeding in different areas and not proceeding in others. And one of the things that this narrative about the rise of China in Africa does is it actually disguises the what's really going on in terms of who's really involved in these kind of neo-imperial scramble for Africa type dynamics. And it portrays, it, there's a very good book called Shadow Industrialization that basically argues that a lot of what would seem to be industrialization in a lot of African countries was actually just this kind of shadow effect of the commodities bubble. So, and this is when you look at Chinese investment across Africa, you see it increases in line with the commodities bubble. And it declines moderately kind of thereafter, more in certain countries than others. And it was very much oriented around traditional kind of like resource industries. Now, the other thing, though, is that what is happening is a lot more complex than just this image of China or even this image of the U.S. versus China. In fact, in most cases, the U.S. and China, neither of them are actually the most important forces in any direct sense. They're important in maybe a very indirect sense. China as a trade partner and the U.S. is still the source of a lot of funding and kind of underpinning of multilateral institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, which provide most of that funding. But when we look at who's actually on the ground doing a lot of this stuff, one interesting thing that kept happening when I would walk around these industrial districts and find these projects people have been talking about, I realized that China was maybe like a Chinese firm was maybe operating as a subcontractor, like they were on the ground doing some construction work. So a lot of people thought it was a Chinese project. When you looked at it, it was some other firm from some other country in Asia. And I say Asia here in a very broad sense. Mm. I'm talking about from East Asia all the way over to the Gulf states. So there were many projects where I was taken to what was supposed to be a Chinese project, and then I would look at it, you know, online or talk to people in more detail, or they have these little like poster boards there that for construction projects that kind of explain who's the contractors. And frequently it would be not a Chinese project. It would just have a Chinese subcontractor working for a South Korean company. Mm. Or it would have, the funniest ones was one that wasn't even, he wasn't Chinese at all. Like one guy took me to a factory and he was like, yeah, this is a Chinese factory. That's what you're looking for, right? I'm like, yeah. But let me talk to some people here. And then I talked to him and it wasn't Chinese at all. It was a Japanese owned factory. The guy just couldn't tell the difference. Mm. Right. And then there's a bunch of other projects where people will be talking about them as if they're Chinese because China was talked about as an early bidder on the project, but then ultimately didn't even get the bid. But people still talk about it like a Chinese project. So like the one of the rail projects in Tanzania, it's a Turkish company that's building it. It's got a giant Turkish flag on it. The same thing for the Nyerere Dam. It's a Chinese subcontractor, but the main contractor is Egyptian, right? So, and then when you look at all of this, and then there's also the problem of like a lot of these projects didn't exist. So like the Bagamoyo port, huge mega port, biggest in East Africa. The only problem with it is that it never got built. No, like it was kind of talked about in 2013 throughout the 2010s and then abandoned. So there's a lot of stuff like that. So all this builds up this kind of mythos of a strong Chinese presence. And that actually disguises this much more complex kind of pan-Asian influence that's emerging. Other people like Patrick Bond talks about this, the role of sub-imperial powers. And that's actually like a fairly good way to understand what's going on is as U.S. power has receded and as Chinese power hasn't taken on these forms that people pretend it has, all these other kind of sub-imperial forces have moved in and are doing almost everything evil that people say that China is doing in Africa. It's either not really doing or it's more complicated or, it's a subcontractor on the project or something like that. But there's some other country like the Gulf states that is doing that exact thing. And no one talks about it. So like land grabs, right? The Emiratis are doing land grabs in a bunch of different countries. It's been very well documented. They just did a big one, kicked a bunch of Maasai off land in northern Tanzania. And it's like literally for someone to have like a hunting range for a private hunting company, right? Jeez. It's really kind of abject, obviously. Another example, again, going back to Turkey, many people don't, I talk about like Bagamoyo Megaport, non-existent port, but there's this other port deal that people don't really talk about. Starting in the mid 2010s, Turkey started to do a bunch of aid intervention and corporate activity in Somalia as the US was sort of there pulling back slightly. And now it's basically the biggest foreign force in Somalia other than some of the remnant US stuff and the US has some oil interests. The Turkish company signed a deal with the port in Mogadishu to run it in like 2014, and then it's been extended several times. They also basically signed a deal to become the Navy. So like the Turkish Navy patrols Somalian waters as the Navy, right? Like all this stuff that people were like doing these, China doesn't do any of it. It has one base in Djibouti, right? But it doesn't patrol waters actively. It engages in collaborative security operations of the Red Sea and that sort of thing. But like people were talking about it, like China's going to start patrolling. It's going to have a bunch of ports that it's going to park military ships at. And China didn't do any of that really. But like the Turks did, right? And no one talks about the fact that they're so important. And then like the Emiratis and the Saudis are essentially fighting a proxy war through Sudan over gold. Most of that gold that comes out of the Sahel gold rush, all this artisanal kind of mining stuff, it gets basically just smuggled out, not taxed. None of the money goes to Sudan or anybody else in these Sahelian countries. And it gets sent to the UAE and then it gets kind of laundered in the UAE and it becomes an important underpinning for kind of global finance, right? Now there's obviously this connects to a bunch of, these bigger kind of political things that are going on there, but the underlying kind of feature of a lot of what's happening is that there's this contest over those kind of base layers of global value chains in the export of like these base minerals, et cetera, and over these kind of potential new markets, potential new labor markets opening up in the supply of cheap labor in East Africa. There's other aspects to this, but the biggest thing is just understanding that like the kind of traditional idea of of kind of underdevelopment through resource war type things. It holds in certain respects, but other powers are involved in it in this much more complex kind of chain at this point. And it is not at all this big new Cold War, you know, battle between the US and China. And then the final thing that's very, very important and touches on some of this question of industrial relocation, right, is that especially in looking on the ground at some of these kind of manufacturing trends in industry and in places like Dar es Salaam, very, very little of this investment has successfully succeeded in triggering kind of new waves of industrialization. I've talked about some of the bigger structural things about why that's the case and why it doesn't provide much employment even when output does increase, right? But the more fundamental point is that a lot of that investment, people talk about like global China, but really it should be seen as more of a regionalization in terms of investment. An enormous portion of it goes to Southeast Asia and areas immediately bordering China. So that would be that would include parts of like South Asia, so like Pakistan. It would also include Kazakhstan. But like Indonesia, Cambodia, these are the big sites, Vietnam, especially northern Vietnam. These are the big sites for investment. And then aside from that, the biggest chunk of Chinese investment for a long time, it's declined recently for obvious reasons, but it was going to the U.S., right, and Europe, going to the wealthy countries. And, that, and that's generally true of FDI in general. The majority of it goes to wealthy countries, and China is no exception. So there was this huge amount that was getting poured into acquisitions, especially in the U.S., to get higher-end technology. And it wasn't just China either. It's also South Korea. It's Japan. Japan. There is European firms, the Saudis as well. There's a bunch of this money kind of flowing also. There's actually far more of it flowing into the U.S. from Asia than there is from Asia into Africa.
So to stop you for a second then, the sense we get then of like this grand multipolar realignment in which China using finance, using development money, using its like centralized power, but also its surplus capital of going and replacing like the United States and Europe as like the dominant developmental power in the region. It seems to me that what you're saying is that's as much a like an obsession of say the American ruling class and its fear of the rise of Asian powers than it is actual reality, right? So the narrative that we're getting that you're kind of undermining right now, is that just our ruling class like molding and crying and coping and seething? Because more broadly, a lot of the kind of like epicenter of capital is moving east?
So that's part of it. Part of it is also that American imperial power is always projects an image of its own decline. Ever since like early on, America is always on the verge of apocalypse. That's just like a normal thing.
It's our millenarian tradition.
Yeah. And part of how our imperial structure works is by projecting that image all the time. So there's always some imminent existential threat that we kind of pose ourselves against. And that gives us a civilizational project or whatever. And maybe that's been weakening over time or whatever. But on the other hand, it is a genuine recognition that there is this kind of rising Eastern bloc of capital that isn't Chinese, but in which China is a huge anchor, right? It's an awareness that there's been a bunch of specific aspects of these kind of productive forms of knowledge and experience that we've kind of lost and are now performed elsewhere, right? And a lot of that gets concentrated in China, and that's perceived as a threat. We see that in this attempt, this very strong attempt to like regain certain higher end industries that we feel like we'd lost out on. And that's a huge portion of what's going on. And in that sense, a lot of these U.S., what are called like trade war things should really be understood more as like a punching down enforcement of the hegemony, the hegemonic position of U.S. Capital, right? Rather than like a head-on-head kind of trade war with an ascendant power like Japan was in the 70s or 80s. We're not competing at the same level that we were then in terms of across head to head and across a bunch of high tech product lines, right? We're really trying to stop China from getting to that point. Mm. So it's more like this keeping, you know, suppressing that potential rather than being in the midst of some spectacular kind of trade war, Cold War style. China is just as powerful as the U.S. because it's really not. I mean, the economy is big, but like there's a lot of people, right? So the per capita figure is not that big. If you look back at like the mid late 2010s, Chinese per capita GDP was about where like Japan was in like the 1950s. So like before a lot of the industrialization. I mean, it's got a lot long way to go to get to that point where we're really in head to head competition across a bunch of product lines. So I would say it is a myth, and it disguises this more complex thing that's going on, and the fact that maybe American hegemony in many ways is declining in certain respects, and there we've lost productive capacities, but we retain that power nonetheless. Hmm. And there is no bloc. There is no power that's an ascendant hegemon in a full for the full sense. There's no multipolar institution that's capable of doing it, right? So I like to draw this term from a book that Samir Amin wrote in the 90s. He basically described that condition. He said, rather than like a hegemonic shift, because at the time it wasn't clear that China was going to be in that position, rather than a hegemonic shift, we might be entering into like an empire of chaos, basically, where hegemony declines and decays for certain structural reasons, but nothing quite replaces it. And so all these kind of lower order powers can move in at those bottom rungs of the supply chain and fight these proxy wars and do all this stuff that we're kind of seeing.
Almost like Origi's argument.
It's similar to Origi's argument, except Origi very much thought by the end of his life that China was going to be in that position, and that it would also kind of save market society in this weird way. It would be like a non-capitalist market society, right? But it creates in the U.S. itself, with this question of industrial relocation, it creates this issue of how do we understand reindustrialization, reshoring, et cetera, and its relationship to these ascendant blocks of capital in play, not just China, but like in Japan, in South Korea, in Taiwan, which are all investing in, you know, industrial facilities in like the U.S. South. Mm. Yeah, and so that creates very concrete issues of productive subjectivity and like this dearth of engineers. And maybe Nick can talk more about that, what has been coming up about this kind of engineering side for U.S. kind of reindustrialization.
So, yeah, I could talk about that for hours, but I won't. I do want to give one example I will start with. Phil says something important, a lot of important things, but the one I'll focus on here is this perception that there's this rising Chinese, like, you know, techno-futuristic, like, oh my God, they're going to make all the new fancy high tech and the U.S. is going to be left behind. And like, that's an appearance, you know, that I'll talk about in a sec with like the actual on the ground realities. But a big part of why that appearance exists is because like the other thing that Phil said, that like, there's, you know, the U.S. still holds this very kind of strong, powerful, systemic kind of like reign in like the supply chain world. And I mean, I say the U.S. and it is, you know, the U.S. is a, you know, colossal, you know, we're the biggest economy, but the Western European countries, a lot, you know, similar kind of thing going on here, where there's like a lot of these companies ever since the 70s that, you know, prior to the 70s, you know, the image of like big industrial corporations was these like big vertically integrated, whatever, that was kind of like the popular image of it. And what happened is that, you know, that was like much more true then than it is now. But a lot of these corporations, we all know the classic offshoring story, that, you know, things that were once, you know, proudly made in the USA by our good old, you know, workers here, whatever the narrative goes, got, you know, evilly shipped off to the dastardly, you know, first the Japanese and then now, you know, people see it, all these factories in China, and conclude it's a similar thing. It's just objectively true that a lot of production is done over there, but it's not done like in this way where like the effects are like the negative effects are have to be suffered by like workers in terms of like losing good paying jobs or whatever. But you know, the capitalists who do it, they're the ones who are obviously making out like bandits, or else they wouldn't have done that. What they're doing is they're just like letting all the parts of the supply chain that they can like leave to other countries to kind of compete, like firms within like in China can compete against each other to like get these contracts, or I mean, it doesn't always work that way in China, but like you basically like retreat to the top of the value chain, and you like get all like steal as much of the surplus value you can for yourself as like the company who kind of nominally owns the like the end product of the whole process, and then you let the other parts of the supply chain just kind of fight amongst themselves for like the scraps. That's the kind of like strategy. And so it gives this appearance of like, you know, in the US, you look around and I mean, there are factories all over the place, but the thing is not that many people and like like proportionally work in, you know, factories anymore here in the US. It's like the proportion of the population that does that like plummeted. And so it appears that like, oh, we don't make anything here anymore. And now they make everything over there. We do make things here. But there are some things that get made more over there because it's a part of the supply chain that's, you know, maybe it's more labor intensive or whatever combination of like socioeconomic factors led to just being concentrated in China. And a really good example is where I'm getting at is batteries. And so like, I mean, there's obviously like a million different types of batteries, but for kind of like larger batteries that would go into like industrial equipment or like military hardware or like vehicles, stuff like that. So I personal anecdote, I interviewed at a company that I need to make sure I don't like dox myself or them, but basically, they're a company that they make batteries. They make these big industrial batteries. And, when I went to go do my interview at their site, it was really crazy because they make the whole battery like on site. I mean, you know, they have to buy the like aluminum from somewhere. They buy, you know, some plastic components, get injection molded elsewhere. But it was crazy. There was like, it was a small company and they have like 60, 70 machines. And they go from just like hunks of raw material to like a finished freaking battery at the end, like, which is like nuts. It's so rare to see that. And the reason it's nuts to see that is because usually supply chains are like any given product is usually made across like a bunch of different sites. And like oftentimes those sites are owned by different companies. It's not like it's one company with a bunch of different like campuses or whatever. And so what the thing was that, this company was like, if you look at their website, it's very like patriotic, gung-ho America, like, yeah, made in America, American industry, woo. And then you get there and literally every single person running the company was Chinese, except for one guy who was South Korean. And the reason for that is because like all the batteries, so they told me this figure, they're like, yeah, there's two battery factories in the US. And this was a pre-pandemic. They're like, there's two battery factories in the US and we're one of them. So, you know, we don't have a lot of competition here. And the thing is all, you know, battery manufacturing expertise is like, I say is, but I'm really, this has changed massively in the last couple of years. I'll talk about that in a second. But like at the time, battery manufacturing knowledge was primarily based in East Asia, really Japan, South Korea, and China. Those are like the three big places where batteries of this kind were manufactured. And so, yeah, maybe the batteries get designed here by electrical engineers and chemical engineers or whatever. But then it's all the like manufacturing expertise and knowledge, which is, you know, like most of the knowledge required for to get these things out the door. Like, you know, it's not like manufacturing is this ancillary thing to design. It's kind of the other way around, really. And so all the machines were all like, they were all Japanese, Korean, and Chinese machines. I didn't get the job. Thankfully, it looked like an awful place to work. But the guy who would have been my boss literally didn't speak English. And my Mandarin was like, it's still bad. But it was like even worse at the time. And so it would have been tough. And so there's like the problem though, is that like all the, like they couldn't just like hire a bunch of American manufacturing engineers. And it's not like we don't have manufacturing engineers here. We have, you know, great manufacturing engineers and like electrical engineers and stuff like that here in the US. I happen to be a mechanical engineer, so I don't know why the fuck they were interviewing me, but like, the specific knowledge required to actually turn like these sheets of aluminum into, you know, through all these machines and then turn them into like a honest to God battery. Like literally they just didn't have people here in the US to do that. Despite the fact that, you know, companies that make batteries, like all the, like most of the, I guess like the monetary kind of quote unquote value capture happening after that for like all those products get, you know, all that gets captured here in the kind of what we call the global North. Mm-hmm. And so, it's this weird dichotomy. Now what's happened since then is that, with the growth of, because I was looking this up, I was like in preparation for this, I was like, oh, this is a good anecdote. Let me like see what's going on in the battery world here right now in the US. And now I looked up, there's like 12, 17, 19 battery fabrication plants in the U.S. And my understanding is that's chiefly because of electric vehicles. So I don't work in that industry currently, and so I don't, or ever really, but I don't know exactly like what, how that kind of like looks on the ground. But if I had to guess, like it, there's like, I don't know how much of, you know, how much knowledge you're having to import from East Asia to make that happen. But I can say is that like there's the biggest roadblocks are probably all like engineering and like manufacturing process development, and just, you know, really locking in those processes to actually make these batteries at scale. And that's kind of like a, and the reason I like focus on this example is one, cause I just like, you know, happened to me personally, but the, it's kind of emblematic of these, of this, like kind of in general, like this reshoring kind of this like engineering expertise, quote unquote shortcoming. Like it's not that like we don't have, you know, engineers here in the US, we have like a bajillion engineers, so many of us. It's just that we know how to make other things, and right. Or like maybe we even know how to make kind of like the things that are getting quote unquote reshored. Like, you know, there's plenty of engineers in the US who know how to make semiconductor related stuff. Like I used to work in the semiconductor industry, but all like, you know, given that so much of that got moved to, Taiwan is like where, you know, we all know TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. Now that they're coming back, you know, there's the whole, it's all over the news, or it was at least all over all the news headlines. Like they're struggling with getting engineers to, you know, to do all this stuff. And part of it's like a culture clash, you know, they're like, these stupid Americans don't want to work for like 12 hours a day or whatever.
Right.
Which, you know, fuck that. But there's also like, you know, all the machines that are used to do it. It's, they're all over in Asia. Like, you know, of course, you know, no one here is going to know how to like really like wring the most out of them. So
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I looked up that, that Taiwan semiconductor, plant. So they're going to build that in Arizona, near Phoenix, using these subsidies from the CHIPS Act. And it was, they cited a lack of specialized labor, like you said, as part of the reasons for delays, as well as COVID and licensing issues. And then they also had problems with the local unions who objected to them importing Taiwanese workers. And so they've reached a deal, pretty recently, maybe a month ago, that the unions and the Taiwanese ownership would negotiate hiring and transparency in general. I mean, I'm just sort of unclear to me like why it's so important, other than this concept of reshoring or friendshoring, that semiconductors are made in the United States. Is this kind of this vision of like making Shenzhen style factories in the US? Mm. Is this what Biden's vision of making America great again looks like?
Well, I'll comment a little bit about that, because there's a couple good kind of anecdotes that I think touch on the basic problem there. If we recall the saga of Foxconn in Wisconsin, I think it's the really good kind of example of how this is sort of sold as what you just said, like, are we going to have like Shenzhen style, like factory complexes in the US again, right? Employing masses of workers, or is it going to be something different? So just to go through it very quickly, Trump, right, signs this deal. So this is, it's kind of funny how this emerged, because Terry Goh, the guy who is CEO of Foxconn, he ran for president as well, but he lost. And then Trump, they're both these like businessmen who like to do this particular thing that's very popular in businesses, kind of like throw out these bullshit plans as a negotiating strategy that then will often kind of like for Foxconn, what it does, it says, oh, well, we're thinking about relocating a plant to here. And what that does is it helps to enforce price, like cost discipline at the existing plants who are afraid of like, oh shit, they're talking about opening a plant in India. So we need to cut costs so that they don't do that, right? So Go is kind of like doing this. And then Trump is doing this in like this political sense of like, you know, I'm going to bring manufacturing back to America. What does manufacturing look like? It looks like 10,000 industrial workers in a factory. And who does that? That's Foxconn. And so he's like, I would bring Foxconn to, you know, the Midwest in a minute. And then Terry Goh is saying like, yeah, we're thinking about moving, you know, some production to the US. And then those two things kind of collide, and suddenly it becomes an actual deal, and they're shaking hands. And then everyone else in the background, all these people who actually like study this stuff, is like, what the fuck are they talking? How would this possibly work is what everyone was saying. So what it was supposed to be was an LCD panel manufacturing facility. It was supposed to be some sort of new gen LCD panels, but that's an industry where the progress of your like TV screens, right? It moves pretty fucking quick. And so that means that the profits narrow very fast in those particular industries. So it's really cutthroat, and that's why it gets sent down to these sub contractors, these ODM manufacturers in mainland China mostly. And they're operating on razor thin margins. And there's a bunch of interesting stuff about how that works. I won't get into it. But the point is just that super thin profit margins, right? And so everyone's talking about this is going to be in Wisconsin. And then the problem obviously is very, very clear is just how is that going to be profitable? And so what happens is they start to build stuff. They build this big warehouse. They make the deal. They get a bunch of land. The local government in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, it's like this little exurb, not that far from Kenosha, actually. They make this whole big deal. They give them a bunch of tax breaks. The state of Wisconsin, which is governed by a Republican governor at the time, Trump, they collaborate to give them these huge tax breaks, all this like just gold, like, you know, golden carpet for Foxconn to move to Wisconsin. Foxconn does. It sends some people over. It buys an old office building in Milwaukee. And then it's really funny because if you read this saga, there's this great investigative journalist. I forget his name, but he did a whole series for The Verge on this, interviewing people. And he just goes and he talks to these guys who were tasked with putting this factory together. And immediately the guys who are in charge of it in Foxconn realize, LCD panels probably won't work. Because they get the guys, you know, Terry Gore, whoever at the top, is talking all this shit about these big negotiations, big deals, just shaking hands. And then it goes to these guys lower down the chain who are like the supply chain managers. And they're like, no, bro, like this is not going to work unless you are okay with the company losing a lot of money. Right. And so then corporate sends these people down and says, okay, find anything that will make us money because we have all this land. We built this giant warehouse. Find something that will make us money in Wisconsin. And it's fucking hilarious. They go through this list of things. Like these guys are just spitballing, brainstorming this fucking conference room that's like falling apart. Also, they rented this really old industrial building in Milwaukee where like people get stuck in the elevators and no one had anything to do. And so they just like scream in the middle of work. And people were just like sit there and just watch TV. So they tell these guys like figure out something to do. And they go through all these different ideas. They're like, okay, well, we could farm fish. We could farm shrimp. We could
High tech stuff, sure.
They're like, we could sponsor a pro gaming team. We could, and then they're like, well, we could do something with, you know, AI and 5G. And they're sure. Like, what? Like, what would you do? And they're like, well, I don't know. And then they're like, okay, well, we'll build smart lamps for the city of, you know, next city in Wisconsin. And then they're like, what does that mean? And then, so then they order all these golf carts because they're like, well, we're going to build this smart city in Wisconsin. And they signed some deals to do that. And they're like, well, these are going to be autonomous carts, right? They're going to be autonomous golf carts that go around the city. And then they get to the facility. And they didn't hire anyone to figure out how to do this. So they just like had the idea and they ordered all these golf carts, these EV golf carts from China. And then they didn't have anything to do with them. And so they were sitting in this giant empty warehouse and these guys who ostensibly worked there would just race them all day until they ran out of batteries. And then they didn't have any way to charge them. So then they just abandoned them. So,
the future of American manufacturing, baby.
Yeah, the fire festival teaches us everything we have to know.
It's the fire festival
of manufacturing. Wow. And so what ultimately happens with this, there's some political things. They change to a Democratic governor in Wisconsin. They're like, hey, I think we're not going to give you those tax breaks because we're pretty sure you're not doing anything at that factory. and then they build this like weird dome structure. They're like, no, we built like a dome. And they're like, okay, that's not sufficient. You're going to have to sell the land, give it back. So what eventually happens is that they sell it. Right. Because it's not profitable. There's nothing they can figure out to fucking do. They sell it to Microsoft. And Microsoft's like, you know what? I know exactly what to do with this big chunk of land near the Great Lakes. Data center.
Oh, boy.
Right. So this represents very concisely. And this is also the turn right from Trump signing the deal to Biden when Microsoft buys it is under Biden and under this new industrial kind of plan, right? This represents an important shift that happened between the two, where Trump has these big, spectacular false ideas, right, that he's kind of advertising, speaking about without really knowing about it, that we're going to bring all these big factories back. And Biden is much more focused, like, no, what can we bring back? His administration is looking at, okay, where can we maybe have some marginal competitiveness with some subsidies? And the key thing is where it's really, really heavily automated industries. So battery manufacturing is one of those. Semiconductors is obviously another one. And then data centers is the big one, baby. Data centers, like, we're all about data centers, because you can have a data center that in classic American metric style is however many football, fields large. And there's like one guy down there.
Yeah, he's just maintaining the machines. He's like checking the core temperature on them. Looks good. Goes back to his nap.
And then repurposing parts of it to mine Bitcoin for himself, I assume.
A room for himself, for sure.
These industries are huge, right? And that's the key thing. And this is, it kind of circles back to this discussion of productive subjectivity, because when we talk about productive subjectivity, again, we're talking about something that's experiential. We're talking about the production also of people, of a particular type of population with a particular set of skills, right? And we have a lot of general capacity to do that in the U.S. We have a lot of social resources, right, to deploy for education, for training, for things like this. Like you asked earlier, how do I connect this to like this specific individual existence at our construction site? Well, the question is, where did that knowledge, not just where did the things come from, which Nick already talked about, but where did you come from in that position? Where did that knowledge get put in your brain? Who put it in your brain? Right. How did that happen? What machines did you have to touch to feel that way, right, in your head? Like those sort of things are really where productive subjectivity gets cultivated at this population scale. And that's the big divide between these two industrial policies, between this fantasy of mass manufacturing, which Trump is right in his heart about, like, that's what we've lost, right? Is this ability to mass discipline a population, but that also gives them a certain amount of intimate connection to a certain level of the productive apparatus. Instead, we've kind of retreated to this bifurcated structure where we pour tons of social resources into a small minority of the population that has very high level collectively of productive subjectivity, really broad general scientific grasp that's then used for very, very narrow, very specific forms of specialized engineering, right? And then everybody else is just a fucking Uber driver, right? Or a data center guy. You have this bifurcated structure where you see this degeneration of productive subjectivity despite the concentration of massive social resources in things like education. And this saga of Foxconn and the factory that turned into a data center really represents that arc, right? And we can't escape that. That's the thing. It's very hard to escape. There are ways, but they're very, very violent, very awful.
As we probably segue into the bonus episode here, because we're at about an hour, I think between what Phil and Nick have turned us on to, we have a lot going into the bonus section. But maybe about the stakes of this conversation is, I am like a passive follower of the dissident right. I try to see what kind of stupid shit they come up with social reality, how their idiocy regurgitates like real social phenomena back into the political world to the extent that they have influence. And they're looking at this process, and they're, of course, tied in, include in with the Trump administration and MAGA and all the stuff they're trying to do. And what they call it is a competency crisis, the fact that America can't do the things it used to do. And what do they blame that on? Because they only really ever have one go-to is DEI. Right. The problem is that we've been like putting the wrong people in charge. We've had the wrong engineers. We've allowed women to be engineers. We've allowed black people to work in, key productive industries and things of that sort. But that stupid sense, that idiotic sense of what's wrong with, quote unquote, the United States is spreading, it feels like. And if we don't do the job of actually analyzing the situation of you guys as you guys have done so well, we leave it in the hands of the stupid, most stupid, pernicious, chauvinistic, racist, xenophobic pieces of shit in the entire world.
Perfectly put.
Andy, what do you think we should do? Should we go to the bonus?
Yeah, so if you want to hear us talk a little bit... All right, so you've had your vegetables. If you want your dessert, look into our not-too-distant communist future. Subscribe at patreon.com/theantifada. And Phil and Nick, what should people check out? I know you've both got works in progress, but anything you want to plug before we go to the other side of the paywall?
I haven't published anything new or done anything publicly noteworthy since Phil and I published Forest and Factory through EndNotes. So I'll just plug that again. Go read Forest and Factory. It's on EndNotes site. You can also find a nice printable zine version. You can even buy zines for pretty cheap. Buy one, get one free from Haters Cafe. And then, yes, eventually I'll have a book you can read.
Hell yeah. How about you, Phil?
Yeah, I also don't have anything big to plug. I've been traveling. I've been in China for the past little bit. And I do also have a book coming out probably sooner than next. But
there's no fucking way mine's getting done before yours, Phil.
Yeah, but my I'm on a kind of a slow publishing schedule. So
I don't have a publisher. So
if people want to learn more about some of this stuff that I talked about kind of briefly about China and Africa, you can access my dissertation, which I think we can provide a link to. I'll make sure you guys have it, which has that information. And then that will also, there'll be a lot more information about that in the upcoming book. And there's a little bit in a interview I did somewhat recently last year, I think, for the Brooklyn Rail and for this Turkish organization, actually, that talks about some of those China and Africa things in a little bit more detail. But the book that I have coming out probably, I don't know, if everything goes really well, it might be out next year, like later next year. That will go into all of this in a lot of detail. It's a horribly, horribly long thing that I suspect that many people will not.
You want to tease the working title?
Brick. No, not yet.
Okay. It's a fun title. I think people will like it.
It's a fun title. I have to confirm a couple things before I start publicizing it.
Phil's probably stoked that I'm no longer calling it Hinterland 2. Now that it actually has a name.
Interworld.
Interworld.
Yeah, that's great.
You heard it here first. Idea,
yeah. The third one will be Intergalaxy.
All right. Oh, we will be right back. Patreon.com/theantifada if you're not already subscribed. See you soon. So, yeah, we wanted to spitball some utopian visions, and Sean's got to go first. I mean, Sean's got to leave, so I'll invite him to give his first.
My utopian vision